Welcome to a new Daily Friend podcast, which is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. I'm Sara Gonn, the editor of the Daily Friend, and my special guest today is Dr. Anthea Jeffrey, the head of policy research at the IRR. Today's podcast will cover one subject, and essentially it's an interview with Dr. Jeffrey about her new book, People's War, New Light on the Struggle for South Africa. The book is an abridged version of a more lengthy book published in 2009. The new book deals with the most important elements as opposed to a detailed chronology of events. From my own perspective, I can tell you it is highly readable and fascinating and disturbing. So without further ado, Anthea, welcome.
Thank you, Sara.
Let's start with perhaps the obvious. Everyone knows about the armed struggle. It has entered the mythology of our history. It is the basis on which the ANC has always shined. But very few people have heard about the People's War, or the People's War struggle. What's the difference between the armed struggle on the one hand, which the ANC began in 1961, and the People's War, which began in 1984?
The armed struggle was a much simpler concept, really. The idea there was that the ANC would embark essentially on sabotage attacks. They would be aimed primarily at installations rather than at targeting people. And the armed struggle began in 1961, as you say, very much at the behest of the South African Communist Party and very much with the help of the Soviet Union. But the armed struggle was always singularly inept. The ANC struggled to bring its cadres back into the country. It made one real attempt in the Wanky campaign back in 1967. And after that, it really just found it almost impossible to get enough people back into the country. Things improved a little bit after the Soweto Revolt, but it was still very difficult. And critically, what the Soweto Revolt showed was that the ANC was losing its status within the country. That revolt was triggered by the Black Consciousness organizations. And that revolt, when it failed, also gave impetus to Inkatha, which was an organization formed to oppose apartheid, but by nonviolent means. So when all those young people were shot dead on the streets of Soweto and other townships by the police, and it was quite clear that this confrontation couldn't succeed, it was Inkatha that benefited with a great upsurge in membership, and the ANC that was left out. It hadn't started the Soweto revolt. It hadn't gained in any way when that revolt collapsed. So the Soviet Union, which had long been its mentor, became very worried that it might have backed the losing horse. And it sent an ANC-SACP delegation off to communist Vietnam in 1978 in order to learn the formula for people's war. And a people's war is very different from an armed struggle. Armed struggle is essentially sabotage, but people's war had two key elements: the political struggle and the military struggle, the two of which must always proceed in tandem. The political struggle is things like the rent boycott, the school boycott, stayaways, funeral vigils, any number of demonstrations, I suppose, events which bring people out onto the streets, which give them experience of the power that lies in mass action, that help identify them with the ANC or the UDF, as it was in the early stages, really. But you also need the military struggle, which in the more accurate translation from Vietnamese means the program of violence. And that is really what is needed, first of all, to make sure that people do take part in all the boycott campaigns, because many people would prefer not to do so. A stay away, for example, puts jobs and pay at risk. So do you really want to do that? But if you're afraid of the violence that can be unleashed against you, then yes, you will participate. So the military struggle is vital to ensure participation in the political struggle. What it also allows is for the ANC to attack its key rivals for power under the cloak of the ferment that has been created through all the boycott campaigns, the demonstrations, and so on. So you get the impression of a country that's rising up in ungovernability. Mm-hmm. And under the cloak of that unrest and turbulence, it's much easier to launch attacks on your black rivals, which were critically ZAPO as the main representative of black consciousness, and Inkatha. And that's what we saw in the People's War.
Okay. Can I just ask you, It's a multifaceted approach. It's much less rigid than a military struggle, and one gets the impression that learning from the Vietnamese, what one also learned was the fact that it didn't matter what style of management was adopting this process. It had more likelihood of success, perhaps because it was at home and within the environments that people lived their normal lives in. It didn't require tanks, guns, transport. It required none of the expensive stuff that goes into running a normal war, shall I say.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And it was possible to gain a great deal of control over township residents in certain areas by establishing street committees, people's courts, residents' associations that really were controlled by the UDF and indirectly by the ANC. And through that mechanism, people, first of all, became afraid not to take part in the struggles. And so they did. Secondly, it was increasingly possible with increased help from the Soviet Union and particularly with the establishment of Operation Vula to get a great deal more military material inside the country to infiltrate people more successfully under the cover of this ferment that had been created, and then to use the arms and the trained cadres that were beginning to build up inside the country to attack the key enemies of the ANC. And the other aspect that one should mention about the nature of a people's war is that it regards people as its weapons of war, which makes them expendable in the waging of the war, in the same way as the arms and munitions of a conventional conflict would be. And it doesn't matter whether the people who die are supporters of the insurgent movement or the rivals of the insurgent movement. Either way, their deaths all add to the sense of a country in turmoil, and that is valuable in itself. Mm-hmm. And if there are enough deaths among the rivals of the insurgent organization, that will, of course, fundamentally weaken them and make it much safer to support the insurgents rather than anybody else.
So essentially, how well was it executed in the period that it ran from 1984 to 1989?
It's notched up a number of major successes, and this was also achieved, of course, with the help of the Soviet Union. Irina Filatova and Apollon Davidson, both Russian historians, have written a fascinating book called The Hidden Threat, which talks really about the links between Moscow and South Africa over decades. But once the People's War began, then what Irina describes as a sort of Moscow chapter of the ANC, people like Vladimir Shubin, who'd been advising the organization on a daily basis for many years, were constantly on hand to give them further guidance as to what they should do next, how the propaganda campaign should be structured, what particular campaign should be launched next, how the program of violence could be taken forward, with very much again with the help of the Soviet Union. So it wasn't as if the ANC, which was never a particularly efficient liberation movement, had to implement this complex strategy on its own.
Okay.
It constantly had the guidance of the Soviet Union and that small group of people which, as Irina said, had the whole power of the Soviet Union behind them to help it on its way.
How would that have been affected then by the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989?
Well, the fall of the Berlin Wall obviously was enormously important because it encouraged F.W. de Klerk to believe that the ANC was now bereft of support from the Soviet Union. And this had also been a strategy which the Soviet Union had in fact decided on back in 1985, that it would start inviting South African anti-apartheid people to Moscow, trying to reassure them that really the ANC was full of reasonable people who wanted to talk, that its own view was to prefer a negotiated settlement rather than a further confrontation, that it was putting pressure on the ANC to do a deal. Whereas the reality, if you look at a book by Vladimir Shubin, for example, or again what Irina writes, is that the Soviet Union was continuing to pour resources into the ANC at this period. But the appearance that it was under pressure to do a deal with Pretoria was very helpful in persuading the National Party government, the white electorate, many others in the West and elsewhere, that this was really the time when a genuine breakthrough could be achieved. What's important to understand, too, is that one of the key facets of people's war is that it uses negotiations as a terrain of that struggle. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you embark on negotiations, the last thing you do is stop the people's war. You just regard the negotiations as one aspect of it, and you continue. And you intensify it because you can't win in negotiations what you haven't already won on the ground.
So your military, your constant sort of military action keeps up a certain level of pressure or reinstitutes pressure when you need it on the negotiating process.
Absolutely. You want to intensify the violence, particularly against your key rival. And the key rival of the ANC was always Inkatha. When the People's War began in 1984, Inkatha already had something like 1.4 million members, mm-hmm. whereas the ANC, at the height of its popularity, it had 100,000. And it had, of course, for years been banned, been silenced, so it hadn't had the opportunity to grow again. Whereas Inkatha's message really resonated with South Africans. There was really not much support for the ANC's key strategies, economic sanctions, which added to unemployment and poverty and violence, even when the violence was directed against black policemen and councillors who could clearly be portrayed as part of the apartheid system. There was still resistance to it from many people in the black population. So Inkatha, with its very different message, had enormous support, and that was what the ANC feared most of all. So it needed to get its MK cadres back into the country. One of the things that the start of the negotiations process facilitated was the return of those cadres. The ANC was able to bring back to South Africa by early in 1991 about 13,000 Umkhonto insurgents, whom it then refused to disband or disarm, so that those trained people then became available to it in stepping up its conflict against Inkatha in particular. Mm-hmm. And it's because primarily those people were back inside the country that the death toll soared so much in the negotiations period. In between 1984 and 1989, the first 5 years of the People's War, about 5,500 people were killed. But in the next 5 years of the People's War, beginning with political liberalization mm-hmm. in February 1990, something like 15,000 people were killed. So this was a tripling of the death rate. Mm-hmm. And it was made possible because the ANC now had so many of its Umkhonto insurgents back inside the country. It no longer had to battle to infiltrate them. They'd been brought back with the reluctant consent of the government, but as part of the negotiations process and in the belief that the ANC would be serious about putting an end to violence.
Because as I recall from the book, there was strenuous objection, I think it was from Inkatha and from one of the more conservative white parties, about the failure to disarm the Umkhonto people.
Indeed, and certainly a whole number of pacts were entered into between the National Party government and the ANC on the peace process. You had the Grote Skuur Minute at the beginning in May 1990, in which both sides supposedly committed themselves to a peaceful resolution. You had a subsequent agreement in August 1990, after Operation Vula had been uncovered and it was clear that the ANC was still infiltrating large quantities of arms into the country. And there again, the ANC seemed to agree that armed operations by Umkhonto would come to a halt. But within a very short period of time, it made it clear that that was not the way it interpreted the agreement. And then there was yet another agreement in terms of which it was finally agreed that Umkhonto could return, in which de Klerk was confident that its cadres were going to report to assembly points and hand over their weapons, and the ANC again interpreted it in a completely different way.
So there were
each time you had an agreement reached that on the face of it seemed to involve a commitment to disbanding Umkhonto, and each time the ANC was able to slide away from it, quoting wording which perhaps nobody had thought particularly about. That it wouldn't be appropriate for a political party to have an armed wing. Mm. But the answer to that was, well, we're a liberation movement, so that wording doesn't apply to us.
So I assume that these side agreements largely occurred because de Klerk would have needed to have got agreement from the ANC, whereas with a larger negotiating group, it would have been more difficult. There would have been more opposition to anything that de Klerk and the ANC agreed to.
I think he believed that his first task was to do and reach an agreement with the ANC. After all, it was its armed wing. And he wanted very much that that the ANC should enter into binding peace agreements that would create a foundation on which the multi-party talks could then go forward. But in keeping with the lessons from Vietnam, negotiations are a terrain of struggle. You never regard an agreement as binding on yourself. Agreements are entered into for tactical reasons, mm-hmm. to create some advantage in the process, and then abandoned as soon as a balance of forces shifts and you feel that you're able to do that. So by the time the negotiations finally began in December 1991 with the formation of CADESA, de Klerk felt that he had to then raise the issue of MK in that multi-party forum and to say, which he did very strongly and clearly, that the time had come finally for the ANC to disband Umkhonto because no party could go into the talks with an armed wing mm-hmm. at its back, that this would fundamentally skew the entire negotiating process. And as people may recall, after he had spoken, Nelson Mandela, who was the head of the ANC delegation, demanded the right to speak again, and he really tore into de Klerk. He launched a kind of verbal diatribe against him and made it absolutely clear that the ANC was not going to disband Umkhonto. And the international community could and should probably have backed de Klerk on this crucial issue, but instead it was allowed to slide. And de Klerk found himself isolated there. And the ANC at that time was really able to get pretty much any agreement that it wanted out of CADESA. So, for example, and this is ironic, de Klerk had proposed that there should be an elected interim government to be established early in 1992 mm-hmm. to take over from him and the National Party to serve as an interim government for 5 years or so while a final constitution was being drawn up. But the ANC did not want mm-hmm. an elected interim government because it could not be confident that it could win an election at that point.
It could not be confident of control.
No, because Inkatha was still too powerful, its own presence was still too tenuous. At the end of 1992, it conducted an evaluation and came to the conclusion that it would battle to win 50% of the vote, even on 100% turnout. So an elected interim government was anathema to the ANC. What it wanted was an interim government appointed by CADESA. And that's what CADESA agreed to, which made them feel the ANC felt very confident going forward into 1992. But then things changed, particularly because the ANC lost its control over CADESA. In fact, it lost a crucial vote at CADESA too. The key issue was really how were the powers of regions, how was the federal issue going to be decided? And the National Party, the IFP, and many other parties at the talks were very clear that you should have a high majority needed in the constitutional process to decide such a key issue, mm-hmm. a 75% majority, not just a two-thirds one. And when that issue was put to the vote, the ANC fundamentally lost. Of the 19 participants in CADESA, 11 voted against it and only 7 backed it. So it had lost at CADESA on one of the most crucial issues to it at all. And the result was that it torpedoed CADESA. And it withdrew, it launched a program of rolling mass action intended to propel de Klerk out of the exit gate. It set in motion a series of protests. And there was a great deal of violence, as so often, around the 16th of June, Soweto Day, as we think of it, in which at least 40 people were killed and 3 IFP people were necklaced in Boy Patong. And those necklacings sparked a massive IFP revenge raid on the township of Boy Patong, which was an appalling attack in which 45 people were killed. But there was never any evidence that the police had played any part in that attack, as the ANC was then quick to allege. The ANC made enormous allegations about the police role in Boy Patong, despite the lack of evidence. It also said that Boy Patong was therefore proof that de Klerk and Buthelezi were working together to unleash violence, and it used that as a pretext to abandon CADESA altogether and to say negotiations now could not be continued until the whole format for them had fundamentally changed. So having initially been very confident that it could prevail at CODESA, when it found it couldn't, it scuppered the entire CODESA process, and ironically, it put an end to the plan that there could have been an elected government for the new South Africa in 1992.
So essentially, the ANC would have had on its side the fact that its opposition in negotiations is the apartheid government. So from a credibility point of view, if the ANC would be on top on every occasion, because it just needed to say this was the bad apartheid government, they must be responsible, the third force, etc. And they would have the edge. It would be very difficult for President de Klerk to come out of that, because it wouldn't be that difficult to say, yeah, but he would say that, wouldn't he?
Exactly, because de Klerk was the head of a discredited, illegitimate government. It was very easy for the ANC to prevail over him. You know, he had made very little progress in his bilateral negotiations on Mkhonto. But finally, in the CODESA process, he had gained the support of 10 other parties, many of which were black parties. The IFP was a great deal of credibility, though it was increasingly being demonized and blamed for violence. So if there was to be a really more balanced process of negotiations, it was important that it should not be simply a bilateral matter between the ANC and the National Party, because the National Party didn't have the legitimacy to stand against the ANC. And what the ANC wanted after it had orchestrated the collapse of CODESA was to go to precisely that format, that it and the National Party would reach agreements. Those agreements would be presented pretty much as fait accompli to a new multinational, multi-party process. Mm-hmm. And in the end, de Klerk agreed to that. Because after Boipatong, after Bishu, after the huge upsurge of violence that took place in 1992, I think he felt desperate to get the talks back on track. He felt desperate to make sure that there would be some sort of negotiated settlement coming out of his bold moves in February 1990. And if it meant that he had to really again capitulate to the kind of structure that the ANC wanted for negotiations, well, he swallowed hard and agreed to do it.
Just go back a little bit with regard to the you mentioned. Sorry, I'm just going to bring it into the increasing deaths from 1990 to 1994. You raised earlier the fact that it didn't matter whether you were a foe or a friend or a neutral. You were essentially whatever those committing the violence decided you were. So if decided you were an apartheid spy, you could be subject to a necklacing, which people were. And as I recall, again, there were over 300 necklacings in the period of that decade, and
at least that,
yeah. And it strikes me that would be a very very successful source of fear, because you don't have to be proven to be anything. You just have to be declared to be something, and you could become an enemy. You could face death, whether you were a councillor or an ordinary person in the street. And that surely has got to be a fundamental, the fundamental effectiveness of the violent aspect.
Absolutely. You know, the necklacings began really in 1985, and they were immediately hugely effective in ensuring that people did take place and all. Did take part, I beg your pardon, in all those political struggles. There were many pupils, there were many parents who didn't want their children to be out of school. But after a schoolboy was necklaced in August 1986, nobody would have the courage to stand up against an education boycott. The threats began much earlier than that too. I mean, by the end of 1984, there were something like 220,000 school pupils not going to school. Mm-hmm. And many would have wanted to write their matric exams, but they were warned by the UDF that they might have police protection in the examination hall, but there'd be no protection for them when they went home afterwards. Yeah. So this level of fear was a fundamentally complicating thing. Many people might have wanted to take part in the boycotts and the protests because of their rejection of apartheid, but also they were afraid not to. So you had massive participation in stayaways, not necessarily because people really wanted to stay away from work or put their income and their jobs at risk, but because they were too afraid of what would happen to them if they didn't. And the necklacings began to taper off under emergency rule, which was always, of course, very controversial, but it did have that outcome. And in the early 1990s, when the violence intensified, when Mkhonto was back, when self-defense units were being established, the necklacings began to grow again. Mm-hmm. So the climate of fear grew again very strongly. And also the deaths by shooting vastly intensified because you had so many more arms and trained people back inside the country.
I mean, I seem to recall from that period, just living through it, that there was a huge level of disgust at all levels in society at the necklacing method. There was something particularly barbaric and brutal and just awful about it, because it was not just a visual spectacle, but it was an unbelievably painful death, and it was a slow death. It wasn't immediate, and there were responses from the international world. And as I recall, the ANC didn't say it did or it didn't support them. It sort of, as I recall, fudged the issue, but eventually, I think it was either Alfred Nzoya, wherever he was at the time, or even Otembo, who kind of hinted towards the fact that, well, so, you know, if that's what they're using, that's what they're using. And Winnie Mandela went into infamy over with these my box of matches and ties, we will win this revolution type of comment. But I would have thought that if it was an instrument put forward by the ANC and it kept on being used and it achieved the sense of fear, it didn't just happen. It didn't, oh my goodness, look what our people are doing. They really shouldn't be doing this. We can't approve this. Surely it had to be much more decisive than that.
Yes, and of course it's very difficult ever to get any proof that this was set in motion by the ANC. But certainly what they could have done if they did not want it to continue was to be loud and categorical and repeated in their condemnation of it. Because, of course, they were communicating on a regular basis with the activists in the townships mm-hmm. through Radio Freedom. The key purpose of those broadcasts was to give instruction to the people inside the country on what to do next. Mm-hmm. So a very clear directive against the necklace could have come down, mm-hmm. and it didn't. And one can understand why, from the ANC's point of view, if you close your eyes to the extraordinary cruelty of what you were doing to people, then you would simply see it as a very useful tool
very effective.
To advance the people's war. And of course, as I said, the people's war is all about using people as the equivalent of your arms and ammunition. Mm. So if they get expended, even if they get expended in a particularly cruel and horrifying way, well, it doesn't matter that much because you're still advancing your revolutionary cause.
From what I know of the Vietnamese War and the prosecution of the People's War by the North Vietnamese, it was exactly that multifaceted approach. The leadership was always very much in control. It knew what it wanted, it knew what was going on, and it knew how to stop something if it thought it wasn't to its advantage. And from what you're saying, it certainly sounds like the ANC's prosecution of the People's War was much, much more successful strategically than the armed struggle had been. So it would go to shore up that point.
Absolutely. I mean, they were sent to Vietnam because the People's War formula as developed there had been so enormously successful and had been enormously successful in ridding the National Liberation Front in South Vietnam of its rivals for power. Mm. And I think they were very well aware, as was the Soviet Union, that apartheid was crumbling anyway. Mm. You didn't so much need to confront the National Party anymore, which was rather desperate to find a way out. What you needed to do was to make sure that by the time the first all-race election was held, the ANC's key rivals in Black Consciousness and in Inkatha had been so weakened that they would not really pose an electoral challenge to the ANC. And you also... it would be helpful if you could create a climate of fear in which people would feel, as they subsequently said of the 1994 election, you just have to vote for the party that's safe to vote for, irrespective of what you really feel.
Mm. At what point in the negotiations, moving up to the 1993 in the interim constitution, at what is there a point where it could be said, this is where the ANC absolutely secured its position as the preeminent political force in South Africa?
Well, I've mentioned that in 1992, November or so, 1992, they were very concerned that they could only win 50% of the vote and that they would battle to achieve that. By 1993, at the end of 1993, I think things had changed fundamentally. They had set up a new multi-party negotiating process in which it very much did work, that first of all the ANC and the National Party agreed, and then the rest were asked to sign on. They had managed to orchestrate a great upsurge of violence from the time that the election date was set in particular, which was in 1993. And as that upsurge of violence intensified, so I think people became ever more desperate for an end to this pathology. Nobody wanted to really question whether the negotiations process was now being fundamentally rushed. In the end, there was something like 10 weeks to negotiate the interim constitution, which was far too little, because the ANC delayed and delayed and delayed on all the key substantive points until there were only 10 weeks left in which you could agree them. Wow. Nobody wanted to try and contest whether it was really right for this new multi-party process so dominated by the ANC to set up a transitional executive council, the interim administration, which the ANC had long wanted, that it could control, which could prevent the National Party government from deploying the police and army to protect people at risk from ANC violence, that could control the purse strings of all the homelands and so help bring the ones that were outside the ANC's fold into line, that could set up a new national peacekeeping force that would be full of MK cadres and Transkei soldiers who were allied to the ANC. So the ANC, by the end of 1993, had got the interim constitution it wanted, which Joe Slover described as a famous victory. It had established the Transitional Executive Council, which was very much under its control. That TEC was beginning to act against all its remaining enemies or rivals, which were particularly, as always, the IFP and KwaZulu, the two other homelands that stood outside the ANC alliance, which were Maputo-Tswana and the Ciskei. And what had emerged as an important entity, the Afrikaner Volksfront, which was run by Constant Viljoen, a former head of the army, which the ANC genuinely feared because they had a legitimacy because they were now run by a credible person, which the Afrikaner Weerstandsbeweging, for example, could never have had. They would have been as sort of rather seen as absurd rather than any kind of formidable force. But the Afrikaner Volksfront was potentially formidable. So those entities had to be eliminated in the final stages going into the 1994 election. And it was done, very successfully done, with very much through the agency of the Transitional Executive Council, but helped very much by the fact that there were so many people in the media who seemed always to close their eyes to the People's War and what was going on in the negotiations process, and how it was that so many hundreds of IFP leaders had been killed, not in the heat of battle, most of them. Most of them founded their homes while they were standing at bus stops and shot dead. So why was that happening? If the third force was responsible for all the violence, why would the third force kill 400 IFP leaders?
It never made sense.
Why would the third force kill 1,000 policemen and injure 1,700 in the first 3 months of 1993 alone? It just never made sense. You could understand a certain number of killings of the IFP and the police because that would stir things up and perhaps make it possible to derail negotiations. But that level of killing of your own supporters would just be foolish. So, but the press didn't interrogate, the media so often didn't interrogate the validity of the third force claim. They backed it, they ignored the People's War, and of course there were a small number of journalists who did raise all the important questions. But the overall impression from the media was that they endorsed the third force theory and that they simply ignored People's War and all that the ANC was busy achieving under its rubric.
Just slightly back, because it's in what you've just discussed, it highlights that very successful aspect of strategy on the for the ANC, which had been preceded by the North Vietnamese. And I go back to the North Vietnamese on two things: the persistence and the strength of its propaganda, and its ability to get its message out into the West, but not the West's message into North Vietnam on the one hand. And on the other hand is the tactic of you have prolonged, stretched out negotiations over years. You have violence interspersed. And what you're relying on is that eventually people will do almost anything to stop the violence.
That's right. So indeed, those were critical lessons from Vietnam, the absolute importance of propaganda in all the political struggles, you know, boycotts, demonstrations, stayaways and so on. The most important element was always the propaganda campaign. Mm. And so really from the time that the People's War began in September 1984, that propaganda was very powerful. So when you had an upsurge of violence in Sebekeng, which had very much been orchestrated by a rather small number of youths belonging to the UDF, in which 60 people had been killed, 4 black local councillors had been murdered, a couple of them burned to death, you had a torrent of accusation against the police, who had, of course, killed people on the streets. They'd in the end resorted to sharp ammunition as being the only way to restore some level of calm. So you could easily blame them for the deaths that they had caused by shooting at people. But on the other hand, the orchestration of the violence, which then prompted them to act, also needed to be taken into account, and it wasn't. Mm. And then when the violence began against, particularly intensified against Inkatha in KwaZulu-Natal from 1987 onwards, you had any number of accusations, often supported by the media, that the violence was the result of Inkatha vigilantes and warlords, that this was the key factor in the violence, and that message was repeated over and over and over again. So what the ANC was in fact doing through Operation Vula, which in fairness to them, I must also say, was a clandestine operation, not understood at that time, but you could have probed a little bit deeper. You could have found out who was arming these self-defense units and why Inkatha was bearing the brunt of the violence. Mm. Why were most of the dead Inkatha people, if they were solely responsible for it? Why were there 54 Inkatha people killed in 1989 alone? Mm. Again, not in the heat of battle, mostly in targeted killings. And then from 1990 onwards, the propaganda just intensified, in, as did the killings. And the focus was so much on the Third Force, the idea that de Klerk and Buthelezi were orchestrating a sort of sinister program of violence in which elements within the security forces were cooperating with Inkatha in order to kill the innocent on the streets, in order to weaken the ANC. And despite all the weaknesses in that theory, along the lines that we've already discussed, the media generally endorsed it. They didn't subject it to critical scrutiny.
I mean, I recall that Inkatha had essentially boycotted the elections and came in to participate at the last minute. So the question generally is entities like Inkatha, CISCI, the Freedom Alliance, how were those ultimately dealt with or by the time the elections occurred? Or was it just weight of numbers, they fell into the minority at the negotiations?
No, they were already taken out through the what I've called the end game in the People's War, which is difficult really to summarize briefly. But in essence, Simba put it, Swana, rumors began to spread that the pensions of civil servants were about to be lost or had been stolen through fraud. So you got a sudden upsurge in protests and demonstrations, the political struggles taking off. You got quite violent strikes. And then you got the program of violence beginning with a whole upsurge in riots at a shopping center and other places in Mobutu. And you got what the ANC also concentrated on. You got the suborning of the police and army. So they were infiltrated by MK people. Their loyalties were turned. And in the end, they were instrumental also in making sure that the level of mayhem increased. In the end, however, that mayhem was brought under control, really partly through the Volksfront, partly through the SADF having units there. And after order had been restored, the Transitional Executive Council decided that Mangope must be deposed in any event. He had by then agreed to take part in the election. he was nevertheless deposed, with people like Joe Slover really being instrumental behind it and saying afterwards, this is the first time I've ever organized a coup. And the people put in afterwards were ANC people, was the one administrator, Mokgoro, who is now the Premier of Northwest, and the SA ambassador. And a similar pattern in Ciskei, a sudden concern about pensions, a sudden turning of the police and the army in the territory against the military leader, Obert Khoza, and then Khoza's decision that he was going to step down because he didn't want a risk of a repeat of what had happened in Botswana. In KwaZulu, again, a very similar pattern. Civil servants were being told their pensions were at risk, that Buthelezi would soon be a smell in history, that nobody could safeguard their jobs other than the ANC. There was a document in circulation which indicated that unrest would be orchestrated, violence would be stoked, and that all of this would be used to put great pressure on the KwaZulu administration also to capitulate. And the Volksfront really gave up, I think, after the Botswana exercise, when they had gone to help Mangope to restore order. But the Afrikaner Weerstandbeweging, against all the instructions and requests to them to stay away, had also come in and were then accused of having shot dead 50 people on the streets, which was not true, as we subsequently learned through the Tebbit Commission of Inquiry established by the ANC, which, contrary to all this propaganda, found that actually those deaths happened in the rioting and the looting at the Mabato big shopping center. But nobody knew that at the time. Instead, the blame was pinned on the Avia Beer. They had done much to discredit themselves and erode their own credibility. And Constant Fulion came to the conclusion that he couldn't risk any kind of military action with such an undisciplined organization within his alliance. And he decided the only thing to do was actually to participate in the election. So that really left the IFP as the only organization still saying the negotiations have been a farce. Our people have been killed, shot for belonging to the wrong political party. We don't want to give legitimacy to this charade. But on the other hand, in the end, being persuaded by an outside person, a Kenyan mediator, that who warned Buthelezi that the ANC would put enormous pressure on him after the election. He wouldn't participate, the ANC would win, and then KwaZulu would come under ever more pressure. So the better thing, to go into the election, to take his chances there, even though he only had 6 days in order to prepare, and that's the option that he went for.
That's funny. It's so strange listening to this and then remembering how one observed it at the time, in a different time and in a different place, which is what South Africa was. And I remember the chaos of trying to get the IFP onto the election ballot with stickers. That then, of course, leads to that very hastily organized historic election and an independent electoral council, the like of which we hadn't seen before. This was entirely new terrain. How well did it perform in the circumstances?
It performed extraordinarily badly. And obviously it was a difficult task. Mm-hmm. The Independent Electoral Commission was only established in December 1993. The election had to be held in April 1994. It would have been far more sensible to have used that Department of Home Affairs, which had been running elections for years, as the agency to do the job, but the ANC did not want that. It wanted the IEC instead. And there was a great deal of concern from all the parties right across the spectrum, from the PAC through to the National Party, that the IEC was partisan towards the ANC. It was chaired by Judge Johan Krichler, who was a very outspoken opponent of apartheid, and I don't think anybody would say that he was partisan to the ANC. But the fear was that a whole number of the commissioners, and very much the staff of the IEC, did seem to be heavily partisan towards the IEC. And there was a great deal of intimidation in the run-up to the election. The National Party complained that its supporters and the people who were going to stand for it, black people in the townships as well, particularly rather, were being attacked, were being intimidated, were being told their children would be killed. That kind of level of coercion. The National Party was forced to stop trying to canvass in black townships. So too was the Democratic Party, which also came under huge pressure. And neither of those organizations had a particularly strong presence in the townships, of course. But they could have done more to get out into the streets and talk to people if they'd not been so afraid of the attacks that they would experience. And so you got this this irony, for example, of the ANC being able to hold forums and have in-depth conversations with people, whereas the National Party was dropping leaflets from the air, prompting one township president to say, "We the people are here on the ground." And the National Party is up in the air. Yeah. So, but the IEC did nothing about those complaints of intimidation. It just seemed to ignore them. And the whole point, too, was that you'd had 1,500 political deaths in those first 4 months of the year. You'd had close on 20,000 deaths since September 1984 when the People's War began. You had a highly fearful electorate, and that was evident from opinion polls that had been done, which showed the people didn't believe that their vote was secret, that they were afraid to be out of sync with what their community supposedly wanted, that street committees were going around the townships and making it very clear that there was only one legitimate vote, and that was for the ANC. And of course, by then the IFP had been so absolutely blamed for the violence, stigmatized as responsible for it, and it had lost its 400 leaders and thousands of its supporters. So to be seen as any way linked with the ANC, with the IFP, was potentially a death sentence. You'd have to be very brave to support the IFP in these circumstances. But the IEC also seemed to turn a blind eye to all of these factors as well. And then when it came to the conduct of the election, there were huge problems. And it was just very strange that the problems were concentrated in the two places where the IFP, if it was going to have support, would do relatively well. And those two places were KwaZulu-Natal and the Reef, where the IFP had always held a very high number of branches. And it was there that the ballot papers didn't get delivered. It was there that the stickers with the IFP's name and logo didn't get delivered. It was there that so many of the voting stations just didn't open. So that it became all the more difficult for people in those areas where potential IFP support was higher to exercise their right to vote at all. And then after the election itself had been conducted and it came to the count, then more chaos ensued. And part of the problem was that because there were now shortages of the ballot papers, they'd printed 80 million at the start.
Yeah.
Even though they expected the number of registered voters was about 21 million, everybody had to have two votes for the national, for the provincial. So sort of about 42, 44 million ballots maximum needed. 80 million printed, and yet there were shortages. Such bad shortages in KwaZulu-Natal and the Reef especially, that 8 million more ballot papers were printed at the last moment. But they were printed without serial numbers.
Okay.
And then the IEC discarded the need for ballot reconciliation. So there was no way of saying how many ballots had been issued in a particular voting station and how many ballots had been found inside the voting boxes, those ballot boxes.
Because with that election, you didn't have to be a registered voter. You literally you just had anywhere to present some form of ID.
Yes, that's right. And various forms of ID were accepted, including temporary voter cards, about 3 million of which were printed and issued in the last few days before the poll. And many of them to young boys and in situations where the people doing the issuing seemed to have been intimidated. So then there was really no control. So it was quite possible for legitimate votes to be lost and quite possible for votes to be manufactured and for the ballot boxes to be stuffed full of them. And there were huge oddities. The National Party wanted 1.5 million votes to be set aside. The DP wanted an equivalent number of votes set aside, partly because the number of national and provincial votes cast were vastly different, even though people would each have been given two ballot papers to complete. But at the same time, you'd had 10 years of People's War. you'd had all the upsurge of violence, you'd had all the economic damage, you'd had this ferment for so many years. Nobody wanted to say the election hadn't been sufficiently free and fair. So de Klerk, despite all the problems, capitulated. He said he acknowledged that the National Party had lost, that the ANC had won. He prepared the way for Nelson Mandela to be inaugurated as president on the 10th of May. And the country, in a way, breathed a huge sigh of relief. But how did we know what the final result was? Well, it was really impossible to compute it accurately. And so it was reported in the press that what Judge Crickler had to do at the end of the day was to try and negotiate an outcome that people would be willing to accept. And he denied that. He said it absolutely was the count. But there was no way of coming to an accurate count, and an election result had to be declared. So
it may have been A count, if not B count.
Hangs over the validity of those results. Was it a negotiated outcome, and did the ANC do better than they might otherwise have done because it was a negotiated outcome?
Certainly you had, post the election, the inauguration. For whatever reason, whether it was relief, whether it was happiness, whatever, it was huge. I mean, the Rainbow Nation had finally had done it. We had this elected, completely multiracial elected government. The people genuinely had participated. And so the ANC, and you quote in its own words, had achieved the prime prize. So in a way, again, coming back to North Vietnam, I think you have early in your book is a quote to the effect that, or a statement to the effect that the North Vietnamese lost every conventional battle, but they won the war. And this strikes me as being in much the same vein.
Yes, certainly North Vietnam was different from here in that they did have many conventional battles. We never had such a level of intensity of conflict here. But yes, at the end of the day, it was the propaganda that tipped it for the North Vietnamese, coupled with the fact that a people's war is inordinately difficult to counter. People are being intimidated on the ground. They can't be protected. They are being convinced, too, through the propaganda, that a brave new future lies ahead. And you've also got the violence which keeps them in line because they're afraid, and there seems to be no way to speak out against it, no protection that can be counted on against it. And similar factors were evident here. And I think, of course, the end of apartheid was going to evoke a huge upsurge of joy right across the country. Two-thirds of whites had also effectively voted for an end to apartheid back in 1992 when de Klerk held a referendum on whether negotiations should continue. So it wasn't as if whites were sulking in the corner and everybody else was joyful. I think right across the nation, there was a sense we've finally done it. We put an end to apartheid. Now we can move into the future. And Nelson Mandela, who had so often spoken about the need to intensify struggle, came with a wonderfully gracious speech in which he said, it's time to put the past behind us, in which he said, we can now build together, and we will never go back to the kind of appalling suffering that we experienced in the past, and there will be no domination of one group by another. It was an enormously important and powerful message, and people responded to it. I doubt, that when he was inaugurated and the jets flew past, there probably wasn't a dry eye in the audience. Yeah. Either in the country or all the people who were watching across the globe. But the ANC had won power in this very strange way. Through 10 years of people's war, all those political struggles, all that propaganda, all that violence, all those deaths. And now it was in charge of the country. It had won the prime prize of state power, its words. And what was it going to do with it? It had always wanted that prime prize for a single reason, so that it could implement the second stage of the revolution, the National Democratic Revolution, or the NDR. And we're now in the 25th year of the NDR, which is a very slow, very incremental process. The whole NDR strategy was developed by the Soviet Union in the 1950s, at a time when there was a very rapid decolonization process going on. But of course, the colonies, as they emerged into independence, were free market oriented. They were capitalist in their orientation. And it was very important to the Soviet Union that they should join the communist camp. So in every country, it was planned that there would be a national democratic revolution, which by slow and incremental means would take them from capitalism to communism. And strategies were set in place to achieve that. In South Africa, there'd always been seen that we had perhaps more scope to move more quickly to communism than other countries in Africa because of our industrialized workforce, because we had a strong trade union presence, because we had an SACP, which had been formed as long ago as 1921, yeah. Had been strongly allied to the Soviet Union and supported by the Soviet Union. All of these were sort of powerful reasons for thinking that South Africa could make the transition perhaps more quickly than others. But we also had a private sector that was very powerful, an economy that basically 70% of it depended on private business, 70% of jobs, 70% of investment, roughly speaking. So it couldn't be an overnight thing, especially in 1994, 3 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, because that had generated this new world order in which it was sort of assumed that capitalism and liberalism had come into their own. And Soviet communism had been entirely discredited. So the first aim of the National Democratic Revolution was simply to consolidate the ANC's hold on power. That sort of maybe won the election, but on the other hand, they were very concerned, or it had long been their objective, to completely change the civil service, to introduce demographic representativity, to make sure that the people who were deployed into the civil service were its own loyalists, that party loyalty, commitment to the NDR would count more than anything else. And you needed time to change the public service in this way, time to change the state-owned enterprises, time to change the judiciary, which, of course, one of the most difficult areas to see, but certainly there's been a lot of concern, I think, about judicial appointments, which seem to have been of people without the kind of years of experience you would want, but also without enough clear independence from any political party. And once that process had been established, parliament had been weakened, political parties, particularly those that were growing in strength, like the Democratic Party, had been stigmatized as parties of whites who would never care about blacks. So from about 2011, you got a shift towards what is now the second phase of the NDR, where the focus is on the socioeconomic issues and where we see things like the demand for expropriation without compensation, the nationalization of the Reserve Bank, the introduction of prescribed assets, not only for pension funds, but for all savings vehicles. So we see that the NDR is moving more towards its final goals now that the groundwork for it has been laid.
And it seems very clear, although I'm not sure it's very well known or understood, that our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has seemed to have created this sort of flip side of a coin scenario where he's a socialist and he absolutely follows the line of the ANC and is marching towards socialism and then to communism, and on the other side he's been in business, he's this businessman, he understands how things operate, and he's, you know, a lot of the business community are very relieved about that. But I think that there's a sort of Janus facedness, if one could put it that way, because there's no indication, if you really look at some of his speeches, particularly obviously not speeches to the country broadly but to certain interest groups, that all that rhetoric is very much part of his vocabulary. And so I certainly am not of the view, I will take some convincing that he can lead us to a more prosperous South Africa. But it partly goes to that, and I want to ask about essentially the consequences of the People's War. Did the tactics of the People's War not ultimately, didn't the ANC become hoist by its own petard in the sense that much of those tactics, the boycotts, the stayaways, a lot of the violence, became the way people have responded to pressure and mistakes made by ANC governments. So you, Eskom is owed huge amounts of money from municipalities. The culture of non-payment is huge. Liberation before education has probably been as damaging as apartheid was in education. Competence and capacity aside, there are all those elements that that to me appear to have flowed from the tactics of the People's War.
Yes, and it's quite difficult to get a handle on how much of that actually suits the ANC or they don't mind it. Mm-hmm. In terms of the mass action, when there are violent protests against an ANC councillor, that obviously doesn't particularly help them. But quite often, as I understand it, and it's difficult really to get accurate information, where you get a protest of that kind, it's part of the factional jockeying within the ANC. And one group within the ANC will actually be organizing the protest in order to put pressure on the other. Mm. In which case, it's the tactics of People's War being used by a faction within the ANC. And increasingly, I think you also do see mass action being directed at the sort of right targets of the People's War. So the universities are very important to the ANC. They must, if the battle of ideas is to succeed, then academics must endorse NDR type of ideas, and so must students. And the kind of pressure that was put on the universities, so the fees must fall, the decolonization debate that was initiated in that way, this is a form of mass action which is very helpful to the NDR. Mm. So it's a complicated picture. Something like the rent boycott, I don't know if they anticipated that it would continue and prove so very difficult to end. Certainly they launched the Masakane campaign soon after 1994 to try and persuade people that they must not pay.
Which is always going to be more difficult to persuade people to pay over money than to save it by boycotting.
Yes. So they've never succeeded in doing that. And perhaps partly because the aim has been to change the demographic representativity of the police force, for example. So the capacity of the police has also eroded, and the capacity of the entire judicial system. Mm. So if people are breaking the law, it's more difficult to have any kind of penalty visited on them at a level which would actually persuade the majority that they now need to sit up and pay attention and start paying. So as the rule of law has eroded too, so these kinds of activities just continue unchecked. Mm. The last thing that you mentioned?
I think I've forgotten now. But what does seem ironic is that there's even a commission of inquiry into the number of political assassinations, particularly in Natal. But these assassinations are assassinations of ANC councillors, ANC politicians, or ANC office bearers. The impression one gets is essentially that the tactics of the People's War are being used internally to deal with internal fights and internal battles and competition for the resources you get holding some political office, and in an environment of huge unemployment that is not insignificant.
Exactly. I think that's right. The tactics of People's War, the way in which you can set up an ambush and carry it out, particularly using all the illegal guns that remain in circulation in the country, these are things that people who've been exposed to them don't forget. And because the NDR policies have so strangled the life out of the economy, and because education is very poor, we have so many hundreds of thousands of people who simply can't easily get jobs. There aren't the jobs to be had. They don't have the skills for them. So that the tragedy now is that government becomes the most important way of making a living. Mm. And again, partly because of the laws that have been established, the weakening of normal tender controls in the interests of black economic empowerment have made it easier for people to make quite a lot of money out of tenders and contracts, which the ANC has been acknowledged as a problem now all the way back to 2007. So the stakes are very high for people in poverty-torn communities. And if they can be the one that becomes a councillor or gets the job as the official, then not only do they have their salaries, they also have some possibility of getting back payments and bribes or whatever through the tender process. So the stakes are enormous, and that's why people are willing to kill for them.
Mm.
And that has been happening at an increasing pace until I think the Commission of Inquiry has sort of slowed it down, but now one gets the feeling that perhaps it's going to intensify again.
Yeah. Anthea Jeffrey, thank you for a fascinating discussion, which can only be added to by reading the book, I must tell you, because it demythologizes our history, and that is probably incredibly crucial at this moment, at this very time when the economy is sinking so badly, and our reputation outside is becoming tarnished. To understand where it comes from is absolutely valuable. It didn't come out of nowhere. The book is called, just as a reminder, People's War, New Light on the Struggle for South Africa. The author is my colleague, Dr. Anthea Jeffrey. It's published by Jonathan Paul Publishers, and by all accounts, it's in all good bookstores already. So go out there and buy it. I can't remember the price of the retail.
It's 260 Rand is the retail price, okay. And it's available as an e-book.
Oh, excellent. It's a 260 Rand well worth spent. Thank you very much for joining us. We hope to bring you a similarly fascinating discussion in the near future.